it's time for us to begin, we want to make sure we use all the time. What I really hope to do here is maybe spend about 30 minutes, and then let's talk, have a conversation as much as we are able to do so in the last 15 minutes. That's my intention. It doesn't always work out that way, because sometimes I just get too full of myself and just keep going, you know. But hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit. So this is a really difficult subject. And yesterday we talked about forgiving God. And I explained what I meant by that. If you weren't here yesterday, I'm grateful that you're here today. And you can listen to that on iTunes if that's something you want to do later on. But basically the idea was this. It's the old Jewish notion, the rabbinic notion of forgiving God, is to let God off the hook, to let go of resentment toward God. Because that resentment that gets in our hearts and our souls becomes a cancer that eats away faith. And the letting go of that resentment is what I mean by forgiving God. It's not that God did anything sinful or something of that nature. It's rather my perception of how God has wronged me. Just like Job said, God has wronged me, right? Well, for Job to reconnect with God, he somehow, some way, he has to let go of that resentment. And that's what we talked about yesterday. Today, I want us to talk about defending God when theodicy fails. Because this move from forgiving God to trusting God has to take place somehow, right? There's something that moves us. There's something that enables us to let go of the resentment and relearn trust, or learn again to trust God. And sometimes I think we get into this situation where we think that the way that happens is I justify God. I make God look good. I figure out what God's doing. And I give rationale for what God is doing. And I justify what God is doing. And therefore, if I can justify what God is doing, if it somehow can make sense to me, then I can trust God again. Now, I don't think we always think of it like that. That may be a little, certainly it's oversimplified. And clearly, it's not the thought process that really does work in our head. But I think it is that move that is the critical move. How do I move from forgiving God to trusting God? Or how can I learn to trust God again so that I can let go of the resentment that I have toward God? Now, I'm not going to go back and talk about the legitimacy of resentment, okay, or the reality of resentment. That's something I talked about yesterday, and I'm going to have to leave that behind so I can move forward into this other topic. It really comes from, the reason I'm thinking about this is because in the shack, these lectures are coming out of my book on the shack, and if you want to have some notes about what I'm talking about, then this session is really a couple of chapters in the shack. The book is Meeting God in the Shack. We have some copies available here if you want to pick up one on your way out. A Journey into Spiritual Recovery. Because I think what Paul Young is doing in that book is he is approaching a fundamental question. Never says it this way, but this is what I take from it. How do wounded people learn to trust God again? Or how do wounded people come to believe that they are loved by God? Or, as the shack puts it, a especially fond, that God is especially fond of them. How does that happen? How do people move out of their woundedness and not minimizing their woundedness, not denying their woundedness, but moving through their woundedness to embrace again God's love for them? How do we learn to trust God again? And there's a moment in the book, and I don't really remember if it's in the movie. I only saw the movie once, so I'm not sure it's in the movie. But it's in the book on the first morning when the Father, Son, and Spirit, you know, Papa and Jesus and the Spirit are sitting at the breakfast table with Mac. And Mac is struggling with this reality of missing her. His daughter was killed by a serial killer. And there comes this moment when he's so frustrated with this dialogue that is taking place at the table that he stands up and pushes the chair away and says, "I can't imagine anything that would justify this outcome." There it is. It's bold. It's a challenge. And maybe you felt it. Maybe it's not something in your own personal life. Maybe it's looking at the injustice in the world or AIDS in Africa or whatever it is. You look at the tsunami a few years back or the oppression of African Americans in our culture. You look at the way immigrants are treated and you say, "I can't imagine anything that would justify this outcome." Or you're looking at the coffin of your wife. Or you're standing by the grave of your son. "I can't imagine anything that would justify this outcome." And that's when our defensive faithfulness kicks in. Right? It's when our faith becomes defensive. And we begin to think about, okay, I got to defend God here, right? And we come up with all kinds of strategies to defend God. And my kind of, you know, there's one part of me that says, okay, that's a good thing in one sense. Yes, let's think about the reality in which we live and the story in which we live and what are some of the factors that are part of our reality and how do they connect with the brokenness and woundedness in our reality. And theologians and philosophers of religion have been doing this for a long time, trying to come up with ways to justify God. It's called theodicy. Right? Theodicy. And there are all kinds of strategies for that. There's a free will strategy, which probably all of us have used at one point or another. Well, you know, God created the world in such a way that He gave us freedom and the freedom to create chaos is something that God has instilled in the world, invested in the world. And we justify that because, well, you know, if we don't have freedom, then we're automatons. You know, if we don't have freedom, then we're just, you know, we're coerced. And if we're coerced, there's no authentic love. I mean, if you can't go, then there's no meaningful sense in which you are staying. Right? And so free will defense comes into play. Or we might think about soul-making theodicy or soul-making defense. You know, suffering is a way of forming character. And it matures us, makes us. But here's, and I don't want to get into all those strategies, but here's my bottom line about the strategies. They may be helpful in certain ways. They may have some intellectual dimensions to them that we really do need to take into account and think about. But fundamentally, it seems to me they all have a lot of holes. And that whatever our defensive strategy is for justifying God, it never measures up to fully justify God. There are always other strategies. And even if, you know, theologians work with this in all kinds of ways. I mean, there are process theologians or panentheistic theologians or open theists. There are classical theologians. And all up and down the scale, what they're all wrestling with is, how do we do something with this evil in the world? How do we figure out how there can be a good God while there's all this evil in the world, and the amount of the evil and the quality of the evil and the depth of the evil? How is it that there's a good God when all of that has taken place? If theologians are, we just churn it out, you know, trying to figure out what that is. Defending God. Even a recent book says this is the way the world is because this is the only way God could have created the world. This is inherent in God. And, you know, I've never ultimately found any of them satisfying. Helpful? Yeah. Dimensions of it? Certainly things to take account of. But fully explanatory? Not in my view. So what are we going to do with that? I mean, if that's true. Now, some people wouldn't say that's true. Some people would say, no, we can do a good theodicy here. We can make theodicy work. And, okay, yeah, let's try. Seems to me it's always flawed, even though at times helpful. So what do we do with it? Well, it seems to me that the strategy that is most employed in the story of Scripture is a strategy of protest. Protest. These are the lament songs. This is the struggle of Ecclesiastes. Right? Kohelet. Looking at the world and saying, this is an enigma. You know. This is the strategy of Job. You know, Job, in the first part of his lament, is just kill me. You know, just get it over with. That's from chapter 3 to chapter 14. Just get it over with, kill me. You know? What? Boy, you are really sadistic to let me live through this. Just kill me. And then he changes his tune. You know what he changes to? He says, all right, I want to see the indictment before you kill me. I want to see what it is I did. And so he takes him to court, basically. Takes God to court from chapter 14, which comes to a climax in chapter 31. When he says, I want the bill of indictment. You know, if I'd done this, if I had lusted with my eyes, if I had mistreated the poor, if I had mistreated the earth, okay, I would deserve this. But I want to see the indictment. You got to justify yourself, God. Right? It's protest. So I think if we move in that world a little bit, where our relationship with God is one of protest, one of another way of saying that, of kind of throwing God to the ground and wrestling with God, right? Which is valued by the Hebraic tradition. I mean, 40% of the Psalms are laments, right? I mean, that's valued in the story. I think it's valued in the story of Job. I think when God comes to Job and God says to Job, brace yourself like a human being. I created you to wrestle with me. You see, that's how I read that. Not that I created you and who are you to even talk to me. I created you. You were made in my image. Wrestle with me. Protest. liturgy, I think, that it doesn't resolve, but it does encounter. And you see, I think this is the move. How do we learn to trust God again? How does Job learn to trust God again? And let me suggest three things. Good 3-point sermon. Maybe one of them will be good. You know, that's what Tom Long said, right? Every sermon should have at least one good point. But three ways of making that move without trying to justify God. Because if my faith depends upon me solving the problem of evil, you're in for a long struggle. And there will be no peace. There'll be no comfort. There'll be no hope. I don't think we're designed for that. Which comes to my first point. It's in what the philosopher of religion is called skeptical theism. This is a movement in philosopher of religions. It was given that name back in 1996 and has become part of the discussion in the last 20 years. Skeptical theism. I think it's been given a name, but it's been around a long time. Because this is exactly what happens in the book of Job. This summer, I spent 8 weeks this summer in Antigua, Guatemala, learning Spanish. Don't test me. But one of my practices that summer was to spend 30 minutes in silence every morning. Part of my daily rule, 30 minutes of silence in morning, every morning. And I meditated for 8 weeks on Job 38. Job 38. After God comes out of the box there, emerges out of the whirlwind, his first question to Job was, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you understand." Okay, now, sometimes we might read that and say, boy, God is just slapping Job around. You know, he's really upset with Job. I don't think he's upset with Job. I think he's a wise, I think this is a wisdom book, and God comes in this moment as a wise sage to say, Job, I understand you're upset. But I want you to remember something. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? This is a form of skeptical theism, because basically what it says is, we do not know enough to know. We do not have enough imagination. We can't imagine all the possible reasons that God might have. We can't imagine the possible reasons why God created the world the way God did. Or why God permitted this or didn't permit that, or God did this or didn't do that, or why God answered this prayer yes and this one no. We have no access to that. We cannot fathom that. God's infinite reality, God's infinite brain, if you want to say it that way, won't fit into mine. And there's a fundamental sense of humility that has to come in the presence of God. When we're thinking about justifying God, we don't know enough to know. Are we going to limit God's capacity by our imagination? That's basically what we're doing when we try to justify God. We're saying God's got to fit into my world, into the way I think the world works, or the way I think the world should work. And I think this is what God is doing with Job there and in that dialogue. And I think it's a compassionate dialogue. Now, some people read it differently. I understand that. But you know, as one who has suffered, lost. You know, and everybody has their own suffering. But in the midst of suffering, we become profoundly aware, it seems to me, of how little much we have control over. We become profoundly aware of how little we really know. Joe, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Skeptical theism basically says, I'm not God. God is God. And God may have reasons that are beyond my imagination. And to use my imagination as a measure is to bring God down into my box and say God has to fit my box. So a sense of humility, I think, is the first kind of step here. I think a second move, second point of the three, a second move is, and what I'm doing here is I'm really kind of just kind of opening up my own experience and letting you see my own experience here. And it may not be your experience. You take what you think is helpful and leave with that, and you leave the rest in the room as far as I'm concerned. But in my experience, that humility was the first thing that needed, that epistemological humility. That humility, I don't know it. You know, I wasn't there. But the second thing is what I would call encounter. Presence. Divine presence. It's what humility opens us up to. Humility opens us up to the experience of God's presence. Now, sometimes I guess God can really crash our party, right? And just, boom, come in. I mean, he just showed up on Job's doorstep, right? But I think what the Psalms kind of show us is that in this kind of spiritual therapy of lament, there is a sense in which we encounter God in the process. That is, as we open up ourselves, as we are honest with God, as we approach God, God comes to us. God encounters us. God shows God's work, opens us up to God's work. And this is sort of what happened with Job. Let me give you a Psalm example first. Psalm 73. Here's a believer who's struggling with the fact that the wicked are getting away with everything, and he's struggling in his life or her life. Job had that same question, by the way, in Job 21. He says, you know, look at the wicked. They're playing with their children. Can you imagine how that felt saying that? Says Job. He looks at the wicked and they're playing with their children. And in Psalm 73, what is it, verse 16, I think, or 17? It says, when I thought about this, it was oppressive to me. It was oppressive. It worked me over. It was toil. It was work. It was oppressive. It was burdensome. I couldn't figure it out. There was just no way to beat my way out of that bag. I was suffocated by it. There's another way of thinking about it. Until. Anybody know how it says? Until what? Right, until I entered the sanctuary. Until I entered the sanctuary. Until I entered the presence of God. Now, that presence didn't explain everything, right? The presence didn't say, here's the five-point list that will solve this for you. You know, here's the mathematical formula that figures out the problem of evil. Here's the exact reason why I said no to your prayer. And you see, I can imagine that even if God sat down and tried to explain it to us, you know, let me just tell you how complicated things are, and let me tell you why I said no to that prayer, trying to explain quantum mechanics to a 3-year-old. But presence. And this is what happens with Job. God comes to him. Remember, Job's language in Job 42 is, I've heard of you. My ears have heard of you. But now, my eyes have seen you. It's the language of encounter. See, I don't really think comfort comes from knowing the reason. I don't think, sometimes we tend to think, if we could just explain it, we would be good with it. I don't know. I'm not so sure. I might still want to protest. But there's something about encounter, seeing God, that moves us, opens us. And then he says, and here's the translation problem, Job 42:6. Your translations are probably going to say, I despise myself and I repent in dust and ashes, something like that. Like a Christian conversion story. It's not a Christian conversion story. This is a Jewish wisdom story. And in Jewish wisdom story, well, I think that word, in some of the more recent commentaries like Klein's and others, hopefully this will start appearing in our translations. It's appearing in some translations already, but it needs to appear in more translations if we get it out of the hands of Christians. I'm just facetious. It's not that I despise myself. It's that I am now giving up mourning. I'm giving up lament. In fact, in Jewish tradition, you have a 40-day lament period, right? And so some scholars suggest that this word is kind of like, I'm giving up lament. And I am comforted over my dust and ashes. Because the Hebrew word nacham that's in that text in 42:6 occurs like 10 other times in Job, and every other time it's translated to comfort. His friends come to him to comfort him. Job chapter 2, verse 11 or 12. Or Job even says, you are miserable comforters. Right? Chapter 16. Same word. Even in chapter 42, the same word. In verse 11, that the friends, after all this is over, and Job is offered a sacrifice for his friends who had accused him so badly. Boy, we ought to hear the message in that one. Can you forgive the friends who mistreated you while you were suffering? Yeah, Job did. He offered a sacrifice for it. And it's after that sacrifice that the friends and his family come to comfort him. Same word as in verse 6. So in verse 6 and verse 11, you got the same word. One time we translate it repent, the other time we translate it comfort. I think it's comfort. I think what happens is I have seen you, God. I have encountered you. There's something. I don't need a rational explanation. I don't know the answers. I wouldn't even understand it if you told it to me. But now I have seen you. And that makes the difference. The encounter. It's not going to be a rational explanation that moves the sufferer from hurt and woundedness to comfort. Going to be an encounter. But I think there's a third thing we can say here. Oh, wow. Let me do this one real quick, and then I want to open it up. How do I do this one quick? What reason do I have to trust God? Ultimately, let me say it very quickly. It's the story of God. Or I can put it most simply, I trust God because I see God in Jesus. And in Jesus, I see what God does with suffering. I see what God, how God handles suffering. I see a God who becomes incarnate and empathizes with us in our suffering. I see a God who comes and heals suffering and heals relationships and works against oppression and liberates the oppressed. Preaches good news to the poor. I see the God of Israel in the story of Jesus overcoming suffering and reversing the effects of suffering in the world. And I see in Jesus the conquering of death and the inauguration of new creation. It's the story of Jesus, not some rational explanation for evil. As helpful as that could possibly be, you know, and it does help some people, you know, and some people really find a lot of value in that, and I can find value in it too, but it doesn't solve it for my mind. What I see, though, in the story of Jesus is God acting in the world in a way to redeem the world, to empathize with the world, and to inaugurate a new world. That's what God does with suffering. And so I trust God, not because I know what God is doing in terms of my suffering, or I trust God not because I can justify what God allowed or didn't allow or did or didn't do. I trust God because of the story of Jesus, of incarnation, ministry, death, resurrection. And it's that moves me in faith, or grounds me in faith, and not because I can imagine a scenario that would justify this. Because I'm not sure I can imagine a scenario. When someone says to me something like that, I can't imagine. My response may typically be, you know, I can't even. Let's protest. You know, let's lament. And in our lament, perhaps we'll encounter God. And the story of Jesus may become real to us in ways that previously it hasn't been real. So those three moves: one, confessing our humility. I'm not God. I can't imagine it. But that doesn't mean if I can't imagine it, God can't imagine it. That's pretty. I would say shaky thing to say is that God's limited by our imagination. So our humility, the presence of God, and the story of Jesus. So let me just there's a lot more I could say, and I would want to say, and I'm kind of feel pulled to say, but let me just kind of open this up for a moment and see if there's something you want to share. Yeah.
You know, in my own journey, I got to the point where I felt, in reading many of the theologians and stuff, the audacity of trying to explain God and His motives.
Yeah.
And I went through Job. And Job hit it perfect for me. I can't say everything else. But Job wanted to argue with God. And he said, "Who can I get?"
Yeah.
And finally he decides that the only one I can get is a God.
Yeah. It's God. Yeah. Like,
and he leads you to Jesus.
Yeah, in Job 6.
So I felt like I'm really in a box when I work through it, and I have only one option left.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what I left with one action, trust Jesus.
Well, Job says in chapter 16, you know, can I get a witness? You know, I need a witness. I need someone to arbitrate this. And ultimately, the arbitrator is God. The only one there is God. And God will arbitrate it with Job. Yeah. So ultimately, Job has to trust God with that, even though he doesn't understand what's happening.
Jesus is in the image of God, then God is a suffering God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that we worship a God who suffers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a... Yeah, go ahead. Don't mean to interrupt you there.
No, I'm just saying that fits into... you're talking about the story of Jesus.
Yes.
And so, to me, that's a little bit... that he's just isolated from what's going on, or doesn't know what's happening.
Right, and yeah, that's a good point. I mean, God suffers with us, and in Jesus, God empathizes with us through Jesus. So, yeah, the suffering God dimension of this, God is not one who just kind of stands, you know, at a distant point and sends a sympathy card. Not that sympathy cards are bad, don't misunderstand me, but, you know, just God says, looks at our mess and says, oh, boy, you people are in trouble down there. But I'm not getting my hands dirty. I'm not getting in that mess. But the incarnation is God getting in the mess, right? And getting messy with us and experiencing our suffering along with us. And that's a really important point for me in terms of my own dealing with suffering, is that that the sense of God's own presence in suffering and God's own suffering is something that comes alongside of me. That God is not distant from me, but God has come near to me. Yeah.
You know, in hearing this is so, because to me it seems ultimately what I love is that God also kind of shows Job the reality of like Behemoth and Leviathan, these creatures that do kind of represent the chaos in the world.
Yeah.
And what I see Job doing at the end of when God has done this is that Job gets on with the business of being human. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people read the restoration of Job almost as God's apology, like, sorry, I put you through this.
Yeah, no.
But I read it as, okay, he resumes his priestly duties, which is, you know, why we're created in God's image, right? To serve as priests in this heaven, earth, and world. And then he takes control of the animals, becomes a farmer again, and he's fruitful and multiplies, getting on with the business of being human. And I think that's really, for me, that's the resolution.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, I think maybe, and this is where I want to get, like, part of what empowers him to do that is that he does see that God is struggling with it too, and so he's able to get on to that greatness, right?
Yeah.
He's able to get on with the business of being human, even though it's often unpredictable and chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, so he has that assurance, right, that God is in solidarity with him, that God is suffering, sees this, understands, feels it acutely as well. And we see that very plainly in the cross of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and in the life of Christ. Now, that being said, what does that do with traditional Christian doctrines of impassibility and immutability?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of times people are trained to think of God as, in some ways, being aloof from suffering because of those classical categories. How can we respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole notion of impassibility is a really complicated discussion,
right.
And I think
sorry.
No, it's complicated, and I think part of it goes to again, we're trying to take our human minds and grasp God. I would take more of an Eastern Church approach to say, you know, we don't really know what the essence of God is, you know. All we know is how God has related to us. And so in God's relation to us, God comes near, God encounters, God speaks, God comes in flesh. And it's in our relationship with God that we see a compassionate God who is yet also faithful and stable. That God is not chaotic. That this chaos of the world has not messed up God's head, but rather that God is moving within the chaos to order and create and newly create,
right,
and alongside of us. And exactly what impassibility means, you know, that's you know, I can feel about that in some ways the way I feel about theodicy. You know, that it's something we don't really know what that is in one sense. Now, what it tries to protect is, impassibility is the attempt to protect, put a boundary marker that says God is just a whimsical God, that God just is carried away by his emotions, and that God's anger can get the best of God, and God can fly off the handle, and, you know, that's the best version of impassibility that says, no, 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 that's not God. God has a faithful love, and God is always stable in that sense. But when impassibility is used to say that God doesn't know how to grieve, then that becomes a problem. Because I think in the story, we see God grieving. Yeah. And back here.
First of all, thank you. Is there, do you think, a place for theodicy in traditional apologetics? Or I guess another way to ask that would be, can we use the book of Job to be meaningful to people that have an experience, at least some element of Job's experience?
Yeah. I think of theodicy and arguments for the existence of God, I don't think of them as kind of arguments that are like 2 plus 2 equals 4. You know, they're not that kind of coercive arguments. I think of them as tools that God can use to trigger or to awaken. I don't think they compel. So I don't think an argument compels. I don't think a theodicy will compel a particular response. But it is certainly a helpful tool to employ. I would not stop using free will or thinking about free will and thinking about soul making. Because these are themes, I think, within the story. Right? They are themes within the story. So we can use them as tools to help navigate this. But I think the problem is that when we use them to solve it, that seems to me to be the problem. So employ the tools. And for some people, they're really helpful. For some people, they're just, you know, they're nothing. You know? Let's just become protesters. No, let's continue to think hard, and faith seeks understanding. We can seek understanding. I think that's what God is doing with Job in 38 as well. God is not only saying to Job, hey, you weren't there. He's also inviting him to explore. Do you know the laws that regulate what I'm doing in the world? He says in Job 38. Come on. It's kind of like an invitation to explore. So I don't think there's anything against exploring, but we have to do so with humility. Yeah. And it can be very helpful. Let me kind of wrap. Let's see. What time? 1 minute. Maybe I better wrap up, if you don't mind. I'm sorry. But I have to get to another session at 2:30, so let me just wrap it up this way. One of the things the book, The Shack, does is it, it gives you this picture of a garden, right? That's the garden of our souls. Each of us has a garden. Our souls are a garden. You know, and there are dimensions of the garden that aren't so pretty when you're looking right up at them. But when you look at the whole, they contribute to the beauty, right? So I like a tapestry. Will have all kinds of colors in its makeup. Some of those by themselves might not be so beautiful, but in the tapestry they become beautiful. And it seems to me that God is weaving us, weaving our stories. God's got the big story, and God's involved in each of our stories. And each of our stories have meaning, and they are ultimately beautiful. But when you're in the middle of a story, you don't often see the beauty. And that's where we trust. I trust that God is good. I trust that God is making a beautiful tapestry out of my life. I can't always see it. I rarely understand it. But I trust the God who is weaving the story. May the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, with us all.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you very much.